Today is Thursday, February 1st. We're going to work on blood disorders, heart anatomy, and exam one review. All right, so first question here for blood review. What blood type can receive both A positive, B positive, and O positive?
AB positive,
good. Why can AB negative not receive this blood?
Because
of the Rh factor, good. Can, say, A positive receive this blood?
No.
It can receive the A and the
B.
And the O, yeah, but you can't get that B antigen right. Mm-hmm. So just some things to think about with that one. Let's see, just thinking about it in a reverse way, what blood type carries the A, B, and Rh antigens?
AB positive.
Good. Once again, AB positive. All right, what blood type is compatible with A negative in a transfusion from this list?
O negative,
good. Does O negative carry any antigens?
No.
So there's nothing foreign that we're introducing into that A positive or A negative here blood type, good. Were you able to answer all three of these correctly?
Yes.
You should feel good. You know, so if you're still feeling kind of antsy about blood typing, you know, feel comfortable. I think that was, I've got one more for you. What blood type carries anti-A, anti-B, and potentially an anti-Rh antibody?
O negative.
Good. Good. So if you got all four right, then I think you're probably on the right track.
It's the hormones, Miss Taylor.
Yeah. The hormones are awful. They're truly terrible. Let me run you real quick through blood disorders, and then we'll say that chapter is done. That stuff comes from page 26. There are red blood cell disorders, there are white blood cell disorders, and there are platelet disorders, but we're only going to hit the red and the white disorders. You may have seen that emia suffix before that says something about the blood, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so anemia is a red blood cell disorder, and the A prefix tells you what? Without, not, good. Okay, so the case of anemia is a low ability to transport oxygen, and it's actually a catch-all group because if you say you have anemia, well, there could be a lot of issues there. There could be an issue with hemoglobin count. There could be an issue with the shape of your red blood cells. There could be an issue with your iron. So when we say a person has anemia, we have to kind of dig further and say, okay, what's the underlying cause for that anemia? We're going to talk about a few types of anemia, and then we're going to go into the opposite condition, which is called polycythemia. What is polycythemia?
Too many
red blood cells. Good. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. Okay. Good. Okay. Anybody else still need it? Okay. This is a picture of iron deficiency anemia. And I know at first glance it probably looks like a typical blood smear. You've got a lot of red blood cells here, you have a white blood cell here and there, and a couple of platelets. But if you look really close, there's one of those red blood cells. It looks kind of spiky in appearance. The shape of the red blood cell can become misshapen, and the width of the red blood cell can become different, can become smaller than a typical red blood cell if you have iron deficiency anemia. Interesting thing is, if you get a complete blood count and you don't actually have somebody diagnose you with iron deficiency anemia, there are telltale signs on a red blood cell count that tell you about your iron concentration. And one of those is red blood cell width, the diameter of your red blood cell. And, you know, your hemoglobin may look okay. Your red blood cell count may look okay. So at first glance, somebody may say, well, you don't have anemia, you look fine. But there's other things, there's other secrets hidden there on your blood count that can point toward iron deficiency anemia. So they can look at ferritin levels. That's the ability to transport iron to your liver. And those kinds of things can also indicate to us that there may be something going on with this. How do you think you would feel if you had iron deficiency anemia?
Tired.
Right. Do you think that this is something that men or women more commonly get?
Women.
Why women?
Menstrual cycle.
Menstrual cycle, right. They say having, you know, series of heavy menstrual periods sometime in your teenage years or 20s can be enough to teeter you down to iron deficiency anemia, and you may never recover from it. You may always sit on the borderline of being anemic. So interesting that, you know, a lot of women may be walking around with this condition and not know it. They just think they're tired all the time and not have an idea that this is the underlying issue.
My daughter has it, and we didn't realize, she's an athlete, and we didn't realize it until hers was actually pretty severe, and it caused her to have extreme heart palpitations while she was playing and got very short breath, and
wow.
She had heart issues. So they did a lot of tests on her, and come to find out she's iron deficient, so she has to take iron every day, has for 3 years now.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm.
Interesting that... Thankfully, they didn't stop and just say it's a heart problem. Thankfully, they kept digging.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, because that was very strange. I didn't realize it could affect you to that capacity.
Yeah.
But it was scary.
We'll actually link that in when we get into heart. So
oh, really?
That'll be good, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You guys have probably heard of sickle cell anemia before. This is a genetic condition, and it's a very well-understood genetic condition. We know that people can be carriers for sickle cell. We know they can pass the trait on to their kids, and they themselves may not exhibit any symptoms. So the kids may then develop a full-blown case of sickle cell anemia. So you'll notice here that you have parents with the trait. That means that they're carriers, but it doesn't mean that they have the full-blown disease. They don't have the full-blown disease. If, you know, we run the genetics, we say that 1 out of 4 would actually have the full-blown sickle cell anemia. 2 out of 4 would have the trait, and 1 actually has the opportunity to be born with no sickle cell trait or anemia. So there's a low chance that you can produce a child with sickle cell anemia if 2 parents with the trait have a baby. So, you know, nonetheless, when we see sickle cell anemia arise, we see sickled red blood cells. That means that they are long and narrow in shape. And look at those pointy ends. That's not normal for a red blood cell. Imagine how that would feel traveling through the capillaries in your joints. Ouch, right? So what are some symptoms you think of sickle cell anemia?
Pain.
Pain, definitely pain. Anything else?
Blood clots.
Could have blood clots.
Yellow eyes.
Yellow eyes, yep.
Does that mean low oxygen
too? Low oxygen, yeah. They say that inflammation and fever can come from sickle cell anemia in addition to the pain. People may have to have blood transfusions if they have severe enough case of this. Oftentimes spending frequent trips to the hospital to get blood transfusions. You're right, they may experience jaundicing and yellowing of the eyes. So there's a lot of real serious issues that can arise from having had sickle cell anemia, the full-blown case. Tammy.
What does it mean? I mean, have you ever heard of saying that people die in their
die in their blood?
Yeah, like get blood drowned or something. I heard that.
I don't know what that particular statement means unless it has something to do with like blood in the lungs. But related to sickle cell?
Yeah, because my cousin, he had a pen and his girlfriend had a baby. He had the disease, but she didn't know that she had the trait. So then they said the baby that they had died when it was like 8 months old. And they said the baby died. I don't know what that means.
So I'm guessing it was probably sickle cell. Perhaps that was the underlying issue. That if she didn't know she had it, then maybe
she didn't know she had a trait, but she actually had it. She didn't have, she had a trait. And when they had a baby, the baby lived, she was 8 months old.
Uh-huh.
She died. And this is the doctor says she died. I didn't understand what that meant, so I just
wondered. I'm wondering, did they say the baby had sickle cell?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
So that must have been, that must be a way to say that.
Right.
Yeah, but that would be my guess, because if he had the full-blown disease and she was trait, there's probably a very good chance that baby's going to have the disorder. Yeah. That's sad.
If you have sickle cell and you actually, like, I had a cousin, she died 2 years ago, and she was full blown sickle cell, but when she died in her sleep, but when they did the autopsy, they said it wasn't the sickle cell that caused her to die, but we kind of still don't know what the reason why she died. She died in her sleep. I think, like, she was 30,
they think it was a complication from having had sickle cell?
They didn't say whether it was a complication. When they did autopsy, they said it wasn't because of the sickle cell why she died. But they never, I don't know if my aunt is not telling us everything, but.
You got to wonder what role that disease played in her death. Yeah, to be so young and pass away. I'm sorry to hear that. You guys may have heard that if you have sickle cell, that you have a resistance to malaria. And so this disease happens to be quite common in areas of the world where malaria is common. And that's along the belt of the equator around the world. So, you know, it's actually interesting that having this disease would make you resistant to getting an infection carried by a mosquito. So that's why the disease continues to persist, because it gives you that kind of immunity against the plasmodium that comes from the malaria disorder. So interesting relationship there. There's another form of anemia here. This one's called vitamin B12 deficiency. And the form of anemia that it causes is called pernicious anemia. And pernicious anemia could be from, say, a digestive disorder or an inability to absorb enough B12 through your gut. If you are a strict vegetarian or a vegan and you don't take any vitamin B12 supplements, then this certainly would be a type of anemia to be cautioned about. B12 only comes from animal products. You cannot get any of it from plant matter. Well, let's swing to the opposite end of the spectrum. We've gone from an inability to transport adequate oxygen to a case where we've got too many red blood cells, known as polycythemia. What are some underlying causes for polycythemia?
Let's go.
Higher altitude and cancer, right. So why might living at a higher altitude cause you to make more red blood cells? Yeah, you need more oxygen. So making more red blood cells, how long is that going
to
take?
3 to 7, 7 to 10, right?
3 to 7.
3 to 7.
Yeah, 3 to 7 days. And the hormone that tells your bone marrow to make more red blood cells?
EPO.
EPO, good. Looking at the picture here, you've got a normal picture of a blood smear on the right, and a picture of polycythemia on the left. Do you see any problem with the picture on the left? Not enough space? It's a lot. Nowhere to move. And if you think about our normal ratio, we talked about a 45% of your blood volume should be, you know, hematocrit, and about 55% should be, you know, blood plasma. What do you think polycythemia does to that ratio?
Lowers the plasma
and increases that hematocrit, right? And the more blood cells you're transporting, what do you think that does to your viscosity?
It makes it higher.
Makes it higher, makes it thicker. And if your heart is having to pump blood that's thicker and more sluggish, what happens?
It's tired.
Works harder, right. And then what do you think happens to your blood pressure? It goes up. So yeah, that's some of the long-term concerns here for somebody with polycythemia. Nowadays, they can give you an inhibitor that, you know, hopefully reduces the amount of red blood cells made, or they can simply take you every 2 weeks or so and draw off your blood. So you just do a blood donation every 2 weeks.
So if you move to a climate that has a higher altitude, your body should just adjust so that you don't have polycythemia?
You'll actually have polycythemia in that environment, but your body apparently adjusts to having it. So you live without the side effects that somebody with, say, bone marrow cancer should have. So like we talked the other day, EPO injections can give you a case of polycythemia, and of course long-term issues there end up being heart issues or even stroke. So pretty serious stuff. I do want to mention, let's see, some white blood cell disorders. We've got four here to look at. These white blood cell disorders often have leuko as a prefix. Great clue there. All right, so leukemia is a bone marrow cancer disorder. And then we've got leukopenia, which is a low white blood cell count. Mono is caused by a viral infection. And then leukocytosis is caused by excess white blood cells. And we'll go through some pictures here in just a moment. I did forget to pass the attendance roster on Tuesday, so I'm going to make sure I don't forget today. So here it comes. I'm just checking to see if anybody's still using the slide. Y'all good to go? Okay, so the interesting thing about leukemia is sometimes it presents symptoms that are similar to flu. And you know, flu is very rampant right now, so those aches and pains that come from flu, you know, if that doesn't clear up, then there may be underlying issues here. See the fatigue, the loss of appetite, fever, infection, shortness of breath, muscle weakness, pain or tenderness. Right there, just reading that list, that sounds like classic flu symptoms. And then you look at other stuff here and you say, oh, I don't know about that. The purplish patches or spots, the bleeding and the bruising and the enlargement of the spleen, that kind of makes us think other things. So that could be, you know, something else going on. A blood test can reveal leukemia. And when we do a blood test for leukemia, we actually see that there are immature cells out in circulation. Before your bone marrow releases those five types of white blood cells, they have to go through training and testing. And if they fail their test, then they're killed and removed before they're put into your blood circulation. If they pass the test, then they're good to go. They go into circulation ready to fight. The problem with leukemia is we have immature numbers of white blood cells entering into the population. They haven't been trained and tested, and so therefore they cannot do what? They cannot fight infection. So yeah, no surprise that we see frequent infections and a lot of symptoms here that sound like a person feels sick. Okay, so nowadays what they do is bone marrow transplants for this, and hopefully that can help rectify the bone marrow cancer. Another side effect of having leukemia is anemia. Not only may you produce inadequate populations of ready-to-go white blood cells, you may also produce inadequate populations of red blood cells. So you may produce red blood cells that are not really fully capable of joining the circulation and transporting what?
Oxygen,
right. So there may be those issues like shortness of breath that come from having, you know, immature red blood cells and anemia.
And those premature white blood cells, those are the T cells, correct?
It could be T cells, sure could be, yeah. T cells, B cells, it could be any of those that mature off of that white blood cell lineage. So when people have a organ transplant, they are oftentimes given something like corticosteroids. And I want to mention that a corticosteroid is just another way to say glucocorticoid. So what hormone am I talking about when I say glucocorticoids?
Cortisol.
Good. So something in that same class, that same family, corticosteroids are glucocorticoids, and we're talking about hormones like cortisol, cortisone. What impact do those hormones have on your immune system? Lowers it, right. And if you lower your immune response, then you're less likely to reject an organ, but you're more likely to catch what?
Infection,
right. So that's what we see here. If we have a case of leukopenia, that may be due to steroids, and those steroids do lower the immune response and the white blood cells. So you'll notice there are fewer of them in this picture. Heard of mono?
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you haven't had mono.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kissing disease, they say. Don't have to kiss to get it. All you have to do is use something that somebody else has used, like a cup. Live in close contact with them. Dorm rooms are great places to get them, apartments. You know, if you live with people that have mono, it's a great way to catch it. Some people get mono and don't have the full-blown disease. You just harbor the virus. And then others develop the full-blown disease. And in the case of mono, what particular white blood cell becomes infected with the Epstein-Barr virus?
The monocytes.
Monocytes, right. And what do monocytes do for a living? Bite infection. And so if they're infected themselves, they don't have an easy time fighting the infection, so it takes months to recover from this disorder. And sometimes people are left with a chronic fatigue syndrome. So it's an unfortunate disorder that may leave you with a lifelong issue of CFS. So they look funny, don't they? They don't look like normal round cells. They look like they've, you know, been beat up and damaged. And wow, this is a picture of leukocytosis. Normally, white blood cells are in the minority here. We normally have red blood cells, outnumber them 10 to 1. But, you know, these darkly colored nuclei indicate white blood cells, and there's lots of them here. What is your number one most common white blood cell?
Neutrophils.
And what do they do for us? They fight infection like bacteria. Dead cells. Good. So if you have a case of leukocytosis and it happens to be your neutrophil population, that indicates what is likely going on.
You have dead cells, you're
obviously dying. Well, maybe, hopefully not die. Maybe it's something as simple as a bacterial infection. We'll go with the positive route, right? But yeah, if you've got a case of this, you probably have some infection somewhere. What if it was your eosinophils that were the highest count?
Allergies
or
parasites.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes people go and they get a set of antibiotics, they take them for a week or so, they don't feel better, they go back and they say, I don't feel good. And they may take a blood test, and if they do a blood test and do a blood count and they look at your white blood cells, each specific population can tell us what's going on. So kind of good to know. All right. So that should do it for page 28. 26, yeah. I'd like to get you just a little bit into the heart information starting on page 35, and then I'll break you out for question and answer time. I know you guys have already looked at the heart in lab, so a lot of this intro material is going to be very familiar to you. What we're going to do today is just basically a repeat of lab content. On Thursday of next week, we're going to get more into the nitty-gritty of how the heart actually works. We're getting ready to go into two chapters, one on the heart, one on the blood vessels, that deal with the cardiovascular system. The function of the heart is to pump the blood, and the function of those blood vessels is to transport that blood. So we're going to take the heart starting next Thursday for about a week or so, and then we're going to move into the blood vessels. Those two chapters go great together. They're not distinct chapters like blood and endocrine, so you'll find that these two topics really meld together quite well. In terms of heart location, the heart is located in the thoracic cavity. It is sitting in a snug compartment between your two lungs. That compartment is known as mediastinum. Good. Media means where?
Middle.
Good. Really, the heart is sitting about a half inch skewed to the left, but for the most part, it's fairly dead center in your thoracic cavity. We oftentimes feel the heart pumping on the left side. Why is that? Yeah, muscles thicker on those ventricles, and that ventricle pointing down here is called the apex. And so we do feel more of a heartbeat on the left side. All right, you can see here the heart is situated in front of the esophagus and trachea. Go back far enough, we've got the spine back there. And on the left and the right, we've got the two lungs situated. Let me take you back and talk about visceral and parietal serous membranes. You may have talked about this in Bio210 a little bit. Mm-hmm. Do those terms come back to you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when we talked about serous membranes, you may have heard them described as a double-layered membrane made up of simple squamous epithelial tissue. These serous membranes cover organs in our thoracic cavity and abdominopelvic cavity. And the visceral layer of the two layers covers the organ. What does the parietal layer contact?
The outside.
The outside, yep. So it's the outer body wall. So, you know, for instance, the lungs have a set of serous membranes, so does the heart. And if we look more closely at the heart serous membranes, this innermost serous membrane here that covers the heart itself is called what?
The visceral.
That is your visceral. Good. So the number one in this picture points to the visceral pericardium. That is the innermost serous membrane. I think of it like shrink wrap. You know what shrink wrap is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you buy a product with plastic covering that's really tightly wrapping the product, you have a hard time removing it. That's what the visceral pericardium does. It very tightly anchors to the organ underneath. And if you were to try and remove visceral pericardium, you would actually be plucking away heart muscle from underneath as well. It's hard to separate those two. We next have an outer layer here. This number two represents which pericardial layer?
Parietal.
Parietal, good. All right. And what is in between visceral and parietal layers?
Serous
fluid, good. And so that serous fluid is extremely thin, and it allows for those heart layers to glide and slide past one another. What if you didn't have enough serous fluid between those two layers?
Friction,
yeah. So they would rub against each other every time your heart beats. Okay. So if I were to draw on one more layer on the outside, let's say that I were to draw around the outside of our parietal pericardium. That layer is going to be called the fibrous pericardium. Okay, so there's actually three layers here. Two of them are serous membranes, and there in fact is a third outer, tougher layer. Draw it on the outside of number two here. Okay, and it's called your fibrous pericardium. So here's another way to look at those layers. Mostly water, some electrolytes. There may be some proteins in there, like plasma proteins, but for the most part, it's like a clear, colorless fluid.
Okay.
Kind of like saliva, but not as thick. So you may recognize this thick heart muscle right here in red, okay? And then I'm gonna work out from there. This layer that's directly anchored to your heart muscle, that is your visceral pericardium, okay? And then right next to it, there's a space. And what is housed in that space? That's your serous fluid, right. It's in a space that we call the pericardial space, sometimes called the pericardial sac. But nonetheless, it's a very thin layer of fluid between visceral and what?
Parietal.
Come out one more layer. There is your parietal pericardium right there. Okay? And that is still serous membrane. And then one more layer out, glued to your parietal layer, is a fibrous pericardium. So it's a tougher outermost layer that's on the outside of the heart. So there's three layers here, and two of them are glued together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've got visceral, you've got a space for fluid, you've got parietal, and then you've got fibrous. Makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you have trouble kind of visualizing this, if you've ever purchased double-sided gift wrap paper in the store, you know, one side has one picture, the other side has another picture. That's fibrous and parietal pericardium. Look at it from the outside, you see fibrous, peel it back, and then you see parietal. Okay? And that's exactly what you see in this picture. Okay? Let's start from the inside. Letter B is the layer directly anchored to the heart. It is called
visceral.
Visceral. Good. Letter A is another serous membrane. It's been peeled back.
Parietal.
Parietal. And if you were to look at the other side of letter A,
fibrous.
Good, good. And I think you can get a sense here that there's in fact a cavity or space around the heart between letters A and B. That's our pericardial space or sac, and the serous fluid circulates in that region. Okay. I do want to tell you that there's an alternate name here, and they love this in the heart chapter. There is an alternate name for the visceral pericardium. It is called what?
Epicardium.
Good. So just want to make that note there. You'll see it on your worksheet. Visceral pericardium and epicardium are the very same layer. Okay, visceral pericardium and epicardium, they are the same layer. I do want to tell you about this disorder. This is called cardiac tamponade, alternately known as heart plug, alternately known as cardiac effusion. So imagine not knowing the alternate names, and somebody says, I've got this, and you think, well, what is that? What's that? No, it's this too. It's three different names for the same disorder. So whichever name you want to call it, this is excess fluid around the heart, and it's situated between that visceral and parietal pericardium. And it could be excess serous fluid. It could also be excess blood. Maybe people have a heart attack and the heart muscle ruptures. Blood can leak out and escape into that space. Sometimes cancer, like lung cancer, can irritate the heart. That can cause pus to accumulate between the pericardial layers. You know, there's a lot of different fluids that we may see accumulate between those two pericardial layers. Either way, it's like having a water balloon squeeze around the heart. What do you think that does to your heart's ability to pump?
It constricts it.
So it reduces the blood pumped out. It stresses your heart out. How do you think that would feel?
Tight.
You might feel tired. Shortness of breath.
Yeah.
And you can see here one treatment is to inject, or to insert rather, a syringe here and to remove and pull out the fluid, whatever it is, from around the heart. So that way we can hopefully reduce that squeezing that's going on around the heart. So yeah, you got it. There's a lot of similar things here to heart attack. Everything from difficulty breathing to feeling like you've got chest pain, you know, to pale blue, gray, light-colored skin. That comes from having cyanosis, from not enough oxygen being circulated. So cardiac tamponade, heart plug, cardiac effusion, all the same thing, but let me tell you an easy way to remember it. Tampons do what?
Plug.
Yep. And so you... Sorry, guys, yeah. But you would like to have one to soak up that excess fluid, right? Yep. Heart tampon. If only... Okay, so we've kind of hit on this already. Epicardium and visceral pericardium, same thing. Myocardium is muscle tissue made up of cardiac muscle cells. Just as a memory jogger, you might recall that these are striated. They're branched. What else do you know about them?
Interplated
discs, good. They don't like to touch, do they? Okay, so that way if a nerve impulse travels in this direction, it's not zapping into neighboring cells. And that's a good point, because we want the heart muscle to contract as a unit and not in a wonky bowl of jello. So we want it to be a very coordinated contraction. One more thing about our heart muscle cells, they are amitotic at maturity. What does that mean they cannot do?
Can't separate,
can't divide, right? Why is that a really important feature? You can't make new cells. And if a person has a heart attack or heart tissue damage, you can't repair. Yeah. And thinking back to Bio-210, you may have learned about collagen fibers and scar tissue. So if you damage heart muscle tissue, what is replacing it is scar tissue. And collagen does not contract when told to do so. It's like... tell me to contract. So it just sits there. It doesn't stretch. It's not contractile like muscle cell. So that's certainly an issue there for somebody who's had multiple heart attacks. Okay, and these heart muscle cells can actually contract on their own. They have built-in nervous tissue. It's kind of like Frankenstein. Heart muscle tissue can contract without a brain that is living. How freakish is that? Yep, so we're going to talk a little bit more about that in class as we get further into this chapter. Last two things in the bottom of your page, two more issues there, inflammations. Pericarditis is an inflammation of what?
Pericardium.
Uh-huh. And how about endocarditis?
Inflammation of the endocardium.
Endocardium, good. You can see pus built up here on these AV valves. Unfortunately, that can come from things like strep throat that are left untreated. Wow, that can go and infect other parts of your body and cause kidney damage. It can cause heart damage. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's strange to talk about that. My son, I know my children have these things, but my son, when he was five, he had strep throat, repetitive strep throat. We've given him antibiotics. Anyway, one morning he woke up, he was using the bathroom, his pee was brown. Come to find out, he was smart enough to recognize it and told me, and took him, strep and attacked his kidneys.
Wow.
And he was going into renal failure. He was in the hospital for a week. But come to find out, he had a lymph node that had abscessed in his neck.
Whoa.
I kept asking the doctor, because he had this big knot, I said, is it normal for my child to have this lymph node? Like, some kids just have large lymph nodes. I said, we're here every month.
Yeah.
And it had abscessed.
Wow.
And was harboring all of that, and it attacked his kidneys.
Oh, he was very lucky to make it through all
he
that.
He was very blessed. Dr. Farrell said that he thought that was the problem, and he removed it, and we went home in a few days.
And no more problems with strep?
No more problems with strep.
That's good.
They monitored his kidneys for a year to make sure everything was okay, because his hemoglobin was way low. He was down to like a 6.
Wow.
And his creatinine level was really high. I mean, by that Sunday morning, his urine was black as coffee.
Wow. Here's another case of mother's intuition, too, looking
yes,
out.
Most definitely.
Yeah. Wow.
So, but I didn't realize that strep could do that. And
yeah.
Unfortunately, they said it could have attacked any major organ, and it just happened to attack his kidneys.
Goodness. I mean, and he was smart. 5 years old, noticed his pee was the wrong
very,
color.
Very, very smart.
Yeah.
It was light brown at that color, and he come to me, and he said, Mommy, my pee is brown. And I thought, well, that's not normal. And then he started running a temp, and we ended up taking him to the emergency room, and they tested him, and of course, ended up finding out what was going on.
Wow. Well, good thing got that removed.
Yeah. After a week, we were getting ready to transport him to NUSC because his kidneys were shutting down.
That's frightening.
But he removed that, and
that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Interesting.
So,
scary stuff.
I'm a witness to that.
There's a, I don't know if you can see it or not, but there's like ulcerations on there. Like there.
Mm.
Yeah. That's as far as I wanted to get you guys today. I wanted to cut you open. Not cut you open, but cut you loose. Cut you loose for Q&A time. I'll cut you open like the Hardy, right? So that you can ask questions for the upcoming test. So I'll put a note that we'll pick back up with 36 as we get back onto track on Thursday. So go ahead and pull out your questions. Tell me what your first topic is. Sample ones are on the ends of the old test. There may be very similar ones to what you guys have on those old tests. How about hypothalamus and pituitary?
As far as the hormones?
Yeah. You okay there? Want a quick review on that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So the hypothalamus makes releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones. And what is targeted by those hormones?
Anterior pituitary.
Anterior pituitary, good. The hypothalamus also makes two additional hormones that are stored in the posterior pituitary. They are? That's right, ADH and oxytocin, good. Let me just repeat something we talked about earlier. Does the posterior pituitary make any hormones?
No.
No, good. Just stores, good. Okay, the hormones released by the anterior pituitary are made in response to those releasing inhibiting hormones. And so we talked about these here, these six here, coming from the anterior pituitary. So let's take them, let's go back through them one more time. This is probably the worst part of the endocrine chapter. All right, let's go through this one. Okay, GHRH is growth hormone releasing hormone. Where is it made? Good. It targets the
anterior pituitary.
Good. Now, what does the anterior pituitary make?
Growth hormone.
Growth hormone. Growth hormone tells your body to
grow.
grow good, yeah, and develop. And if you want to shut off growth hormone production, you don't use GHRH.
Use IH.
That's it. Good. let's see. Three disorders for this one, for growth hormone. As a child, if you're abnormally tall. Good. As an adult, if your bones grow appositionally. Acromegaly. And if you're a child, if you hyposecrete growth hormone. Pituitary.
Dwarfism.
That's right. That's right. Let's see. We talked about... Let's get you another PowerPoint. I think that's the end of that one. Okay. Let's see. We talked about thyroxine production, and that starts in the brain with TRH. Where is TRH made?
Hypothalamus.
Good. It targets the
anterior pituitary.
Good. Now, what does the anterior pituitary make?
TSH.
TSH. Good. TSH, a stimulating hormone, tells your thyroid gland to make
thyroxine.
Good. What specific cells in your thyroid gland make thyroxine? You're close. Follicle. Good. Follicle cells make thyroxine. Good. And at the site of a cell, thyroxine, which is T4, is converted down to
T3.
And that difference is one atom of
iodine,
right?
Iodine.
Good. Okay. And so which is the more potent form, T4 or T3?
T3.
Yep, it's the more potent form. I can talk today. It's like a Monday all over. Okay.
And what, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
What was the, was that the direct gene? Wasn't that different?
It is. It uses direct gene, you're right, instead of secondary messenger.
Okay.
Good. Okay. Thyroxine is one that helps to regulate metabolism and
development,
right. And like I mentioned, I tried really hard not to say the word growth, because that's growth hormone, but thyroxine regulates metabolism and development. Okay here, any questions here? Okay, let's do another one. Let's see, we've got corticotropic releasing hormone, or CRH. It targets your anterior pituitary. In turn, that releases
ACTH.
What does that AC prefix tell you?
Adrenal cortex.
Good. And the adrenal cortex, of course, produces three groups of hormones. Good, good. So aldosterone, cortisol, and sex hormones. Good. So let's pause here and take a detour back to the adrenals for just a moment. Okay, so what is the primary job of aldosterone? Blood pressure, good. And it does so by telling your kidneys to keep
water,
sodium, yeah, and water indirectly. And in exchange for keeping sodium, you dump and get rid of
potassium.
Good. Now, aldosterone can be triggered by ACTH, but it may also be stimulated primarily by which of these mechanisms? Yeah, that's our number one, renin-angiotensin mechanism. Good. Do you remember the stimulus for the renin-angiotensin mechanism? Low blood pressure. That's it. That tells the liver to release angiotensin. The liver releases angiotensin, which is a squeezer. It's a vasoconstrictor. And that comes back full circle and tells your adrenals to release aldosterone.
Okay. Doesn't aldosterone partner with the antidiuretic?
It does.
Okay.
It's a tag team because one does sodium and the other does water.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so that's one of our adrenal gland hormones. ACTH may play a role there, okay? And then we've got cortisol, another adrenal gland hormone. And what does this one help us regulate?
Blood sugar.
Blood sugar, glucose, good. And in doing so, it can help us break down what parts of our bodies for sugar?
Fats.
Good. Now, another feature of cortisol or cortisone is it is anti-inflammatory, which means it does what?
Reduces
inflammation. And it does that by targeting what types of white blood cells? Basophils. Good. Good. So, if it lowers your immune response, what white blood cell disorder might you develop? So if it lowers your immune response, what white blood cell disorder might you develop?
Leukopenia.
Yep, leukopenia. Good. All right, and one more here. We've got sex hormones, of course, that are produced by the adrenals. Both males and females make small amounts. Let's review these disorders here. Addison's disease is a hyper or hypo?
Hypo.
Hypo secretion, good. Cushing's, what is that one?
Hyper.
Hyper, good. So it's extra or excess cortisol. And then we know masculinization is an issue mainly for females with excess testosterone. Okay. So for which of these two disorders, Addison's or Cushing's, would you expect to see obesity, weight gain, and stretch marks?
Cushing's,
good. For which of these disorders would you expect to see weight loss? Good, good.
Was that also the one that was called Graves' disease?
Graves' disease is thyroid. Let me go back and pull that one for you. Let's see. Graves' disease is actually a thyroid issue. It's excess thyroxine. Cretinism is kind of like dwarfism, but it's thyroid hyposecretion. Okay. Do y'all have questions on those disorders? All right, and let's go through those last few hypothalamic hormones. One more here is called GnRH, produced by your hypothalamus. It tells your anterior pituitary to release two hormones. They are FSH and LH, good. And for males and females, these hormones target your ovaries and testes, good. In response, ovaries and testes make hormones, and they also make their respective sex cells like eggs or sperm, okay? And then the final one that we talked about with the hypothalamus anterior pituitary relationship is prolactin. So if you're not a breastfeeding female, is PRH in control?
No.
No. Instead, what hormone is in control?
PIH,
right. Right, so for anyone who is male or not breastfeeding, PIH has what effect on prolactin?
Inhibits it,
stops it, turns it off, right? Okay, so if a female was to breastfeed, she would not only need prolactin turned on by PRH, she would also need another hormone that acts as permissive to turn on the milk reflex.
Oxytocin,
good. So let me repeat here, there's a relationship between oxytocin and prolactin. Oxytocin is a way to turn on milk production through a milk reflex. It's a kind of the one that gets the ball rolling. And then to maintain milk production during that breastfeeding event is prolactin. So one gives permission for the other to work. Any questions on prolactin? So what were those two hormones made by the hypothalamus and stored in the posterior pituitary?
Oxytocin
and ADH, good. And of those two, let's get you to the right slide. Of those two, which one is going to operate on the uterus of a female and her mammary glands?
Oxytocin,
good. Let's talk about ADH for just a moment. This one primarily targets which organs?
Kidneys,
good. So made by the hypothalamus, released by your posterior pituitary, targets the kidneys, makes you retain what?
Water.
Good. Does ADH make you retain salt?
No.
No, that is another hormone, right?
Yeah.
What hormone is it?
Aldosterone,
good. And if you retain water, thanks to ADH, what happens to your blood pressure?
Increases,
good. And so if you have, say, alcohol in your system, what impact does that have on ADH release?
Inhibits it,
right. Yeah, that means you're going to pee out a lot of extra fluids, and you're now at greater risk for what?
Dehydration,
good. There's a disorder that's kind of like alcohol. It makes you urinate frequent amounts of fluids out, and that is a form of diabetes known as insipidus. Yeah. Let me just repeat that insipidus is an ADH insufficiency. Does that mean we make too much or too little?
Too little.
Okay, and the problems that result are these two, polyuria and polydipsia, meaning what? Pee and thirsty, right? Okay, so no problems with glucose here, right? Okay, this will be on the test. Okay, so there is no problem with glucose here. There is not an issue with polyphagia. There is not an issue with insulin. Okay, so this is not that kind of diabetes. Okay, so just two symptoms, polydipsia and polyuria.
When I was doing my study, I was kind of confused as to how ADH was humoral control when I thought that the posterior pituitary was neural.
It's both.
So, and I was just kind of reading it again. So, ADH is humoral because it's not always on, but something has to happen to trigger it.
Correct.
Okay, and then the oxytocin is more like, oh, something's not right. But, I mean, something's still triggering it, but it's going directly to the source.
Right.
Okay.
The fact that ADH is both neural and humoral kind of comes from the fact that it's neurons releasing it, so it's neural in that nature. But the neurons release it in response to the salt in the bloodstream. So that's how it gets to be a humoral stimulus, too. So it wouldn't be released without a salt issue in the first place, yeah. And with oxytocin, it's a push on the cervix that causes it to be released from the neural circuit in the brain. Yeah. It's kind of, those two are kind of weird in the way they work compared to everybody else. How about other questions with endocrine stuff? How you doing with disorders? Graves' disease, Cushing's, acromegaly, there's a bunch there. Okay, can I help you with any of those? Blood, blood typing, blood clotting, agglutination, coagulation. I actually don't have you guys do that on the lecture test. And if you've already, you took your lab test, right? Mm-hmm. Then you're passed, you won't have that again on a lecture test. So, but I can review that if you would like to see it. Good. Okay. Anything else with blood typing? White blood cells, let's do those. Types of white blood cells fall into two categories. That's kind of what you want to hear? Okay. So we know that white blood cells fall into a category of being granulocytes or agranulocytes. Obviously, the granulocytes carry granules in their cytoplasm. Agranulocytes may have a few, but they're not very visible, so we classify them as being the ones typically without those granules. Noticing the list here, you've got some with really huge nuclei. Those tend to be our agranulocytes. And the ones with visible granules and lobe-shaped nuclei, those are our granulocytes. The granulocytes also have an ending of phil, P-H-I-L, means to love or attract. And those particular cells love a particular stain or dye color. And so that's what they're named for. Let's take this picture here. Which of our white blood cells is considered to be a fighter of parasitic worms? Yeah, eosinophils, good. Which one of these contains granules of histamine?
Basophils,
good. And we know histamine is involved in an immune reaction or inflammatory response. Which one of these may be infected by an Epstein-Barr virus?
Monocytes,
good. Which one of these is the most common white blood cell?
Neutrophils,
good. And the least common?
Basophils,
good. And which one of these happens to produce antibodies?
Lymphocytes,
good. Which one of these migrates through a capillary out into a cell and tissue and transforms into a macrophage?
Monocytes,
good, good. Which one of these might fight allergies? Maybe basophils, also?
Eosinophils,
right, good, okay. In terms of, not just this picture, but in terms of everything, the most common part of your blood is what?
Plasma,
yeah. So the majority of your blood is plasma. Then let's think about your cells. The most common cell type, erythrocytes, good. And then of your white blood cell population, what is the most common white blood cell?
Neutrophils.
Okay, and then we know never let monkeys eat bananas, right? Okay, never let. All right. So we know that red blood cells are most common, white blood cells are least common, and coming in rank number two,
platelets,
yeah. Okay, so just kind of thinking big picture here in terms of how everything lays out in the bloodstream. The majority is plasma, around 55%. Red blood cells, about 45%. And everything else there is about 1%. Okay, and so we know that red blood cells can give us something called hematocrit. Do you remember how to calculate hematocrit?
Yeah.
Need a review on that, or you feel comfortable? Good.
Well, we have just have to do that on the test.
I've got one on the test.
Okay.
We're going to assume that the buffy coat, which is platelets and all those white blood cells, can constitute 1%. Just make that assumption, right? Okay, so that takes care of at least part of the problem. The other thing we're going to look at is plasma. Let's say that we have 54% of our blood composed of plasma. And we want to know how many red blood cells, what percent the blood is from red blood cells. Good. So those together make up 55, 100 minus 55. You got it, 45%. Okay. So I could say, what is the red blood cell population, a percentage? I could say, what's your hematocrit? That's two ways to say the same thing. Want to do another one? Okay. I may not give you buffy coat. You're just going to assume that it's part of it. So I may just say, plasma makes up 60%. And I may say to you, what is our red blood cell count, or what is our hematocrit?
39%.
It's got to be 39%, right?
So you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it like we did in lab.
Yeah, I'm not going to give you a column.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not going to give you a column and make you measure all the parts. That's what you guys did in lab,
no,
right?
We had to like find the hematocrit. So
Yeah, I'm skipping that step of measuring.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I don't want you guys to have to bother with calculators mainly. Yeah.
I'm glad you said that because I
was Is this something you're okay with?
Yeah.
Okay. Any questions or anything? Do you want another one?
No.
One more, sure. Okay, so I may not tell you my buffy coat is 1%, but that's always there. Always make that assumption, right? So even if I don't tell you buffy coat, I may say to you, my hematocrit is this, and I may ask you to figure out the blood plasma composition.
So you got 34.
Yeah, so that's 66, that's 34%. Okay. I may ask you, is this normal looking for hematocrit?
No.
It's not, because hematocrit's normally where?
45%.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. For women, it's a little lower. If you were to say what might be wrong, what could you say? Polycythemia. Maybe it's something as simple as dehydration. Okay? So you might want to feel comfortable saying, okay, what happens if it's high? What happens if it's too low? You know, can I figure out what's going on there?
Will you want us to give a disorder if it's high or low?
I might ask you to do that, yes. Yeah.
Can you tell us how many questions you're
going to have? That's one of them.
Okay.
Yep. I ask often about blood pressure on the essays. I often ask about diabetes, the two forms, mellitus, insipidus. I ask about cortisol. I ask about cortisol and how it interacts with diabetes, mellitus often. Be sure you know about aldosterone. That almost always shows up as an essay question. And, of course, ADH, its buddy. So, yeah, blood pressure, blood sugar, diabetes, cortisol, those kinds of topics are ones that you'll see pop up on essays this time. Do y'all have anything else? You good?
I have a question.
Sure.
A person with anemia,